The Triathlon Show 371. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and this is the first episode of the new year of 2023, so happy new year. Today's episode, I have a roundup episode with segments from 11 of my personal favorite interviews from 2022. These are completely subjective, and also they are in random order. And many of these episodes are reflected in download numbers and listener feedback as being really popular amongst the listeners as well. Not necessarily all of them. So again, these are just my personal favorites. And the idea is to play anything from 2 to 10 minutes from each of these interviews and give you a reminder of these episodes if you already listened to them. Or if you missed them, these segments can give you a taste for what the episode was like and if you want to go back and listen to the episode in full. Either way, the segments that I picked, I think, are all really, really good segments. And so even if you have listened to the episode, I think that this will be a really good one to get a bunch of highlights from these episodes and get to remind yourself of some of the key points that that some of the best guests on the show have given in over the course of 2022. I will give a bit of an introduction to each segment that I picked and explain it or explain why I picked it, introduce it in some way. But first, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They help athletes perform at their best through excellent electrolyte and fueling products, and also through their free online tools and a patented sweat test. As a salty sweater myself, I love their highly concentrated pH 1500 electrolytes, and I use their gels all the time to fuel my training. And for me, there's simply no other gels on the market that are as good, as easy to consume. They have a fairly neutral taste, but still like kind of sweet, but very lightly sweet. So I like it. It's like a bit like candy, but you don't get tired of it. So when you do really long sessions, you can still keep consuming 90 to 100, even more grams per hour of carbs. And you don't really feel like it's an issue. Like I at least tend to do with a lot of the other gels on the market. The Precision Fuel gels are really the best ones that I've tried in that sense. You can also use the free fuel and hydration planner on their website, and you'll get a personalized plan for your carbohydrate, sodium, and fluid intake, and book a free 20-minute video consultation to chat through the plan with the athlete support team. And you can get 15% off your first order of their range of products by using the code TTS23 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Form. Welcome to our new sponsor for this year, Form, that produced the Form Smart Swim Goggles. I will probably record some kind of mini episode in the next few weeks talking more about how I use the Form goggles to improve my swim training. But in short, they give you real-time feedback in your swim training through a display on the goggle lens so that you can see every split to stay on pace. You can see your stroke rate and even your heart rate if you use the Polar heart rate monitor. And you can analyze in-depth metrics post-swim in the app, like distance per stroke, moving versus resting time, and so on. You can use a library of pre-existing workouts and plans and follow guided workouts, or you can build your own workouts to follow as guided workouts. Personally, I don't actually do any of this. I just do free swims because I do really simple swims that I remember. But it is a cool feature for those that struggle to remember their swim workouts. And you can get 15% off the goggles with the code TTS15 on formswim.com/TTS. Welcome again to Form. I'm really excited to have them on board as a sponsor. Now, without any further ado, let's get into this roundup episode with the best of That Triathlon Show from 2022. So this first clip is from Tim Reed in episode 350. He is an Australian triathlon coach and former Ironman 73 world champion. This was a great training talk interview that I enjoyed a lot. And in the following clips, we will hear Tim discuss some of his main principles for swim, bike, and run training, of course, in a triathlon context.
Yeah, I think swimming is a really interesting one because even though we know that the sort of the basic principle of predominantly aerobic work to anaerobic works for endurance sports, I think a lot of athletes just jump into squads and they're doing way too much anaerobic swimming. And the downside to that, you know, apart from just the physiological stress of turning up each day and smashing yourself, is they start to practice poor form in the water. And we know how important just making good technique autonomous is. And so one of the main things I work on with athletes, especially if I can see that they're not holding relatively good technique in the water, is actually getting them out of swim squads, especially if they can't control themselves or drop down a lane and have some a little bit of swallow their pride a little bit, is bringing in a lot more aerobic training into the swim and treating it almost like I would treat the bike and run, you know, and pretty much only having, you know, one to two really hard swims a week, and the rest is sort of in that very aerobic zone two range and working within that range to build the efficiency at a cellular level, but also just building efficiency with their technique, because I've seen it a lot, and I've been part of squads where I myself and many other athletes are just smoking yourself trying to keep up with a 3Ks of threshold or 2Ks of threshold, and you get into a race and you're swimming worse than ever. So I've seen some great improvement, especially with the second tier and third tier pros that I take on, which are sort of the professionals I prefer to take on anyway, because I feel like there's a lot more to gain rather than someone who's already going really well. I've seen big changes in their swimming actually through pulling them back from doing too much anaerobic swimming. So I guess that would sum up my swim approach. I get a lot of guys to do less squad swimming if they can't, unless the squads run really well, where they do really take a polarized approach to their training. Yeah, cycling's complicated because it's such a strength endurance-based sport. And so you have some athletes who have a huge aerobic history and still aren't riding well, and you sort of have to look at it and go, well, what's holding them back here? Is it their aerobic efficiency or is it their straight-up strength endurance? And so there's certainly with athletes who are newer to the sport who don't have that aerobic history, the very traditional approach of a lot of aerobic training and then, you know, sprinkling in the higher intensity work is, you know, for the first 5 to 6 years of an athlete's, training career or training life, I think that's super important. But when you get those athletes who just aren't putting it together, who have a huge aerobic history, I take a more of a strength endurance approach. Sometimes a lot more gym work to try and build up the straight up raw strength and power. So, it's an individual approach. I don't think there's one approach with cycling that will get improvements. I think you've really got to look at, okay, what's an athlete's weakness on the bike and what's holding them back. So, throughout my own career as an age grouper, I think I was lucky to have a coach who was just very volume based, and then when I switched to someone like Matt Dixon, who was very much about strength endurance and key intervals, I felt like the two combined to help me have a few really good years there on the bike. And so I try and take that on and use that and try not to come to an athlete, you know, try not to approach the coaching on the bike with a real one size fits all approach. Really try and work out what's lacking with the athlete. Yeah, so I don't like to be too volume-based on the bike, but I do think volume is important on the run in terms of people could be doing, to compare the two, you know, people could say, oh, I've been riding 800 kilometres a week. And in my mind, that doesn't really mean anything because, you know, you could be sitting behind a motorbike for a 200K ride and it takes you 3 hours, or you could be sitting in a Peloton, you know, in zone one, ticking along at 40 kilometers an hour. Whereas on the run, I feel like this might be a bit controversial, but I don't feel like there's never junk mileage in that there's always a stress on the body, no matter what pace you're going. It has to all be factored in, and it's not the worst measure of the load that you're doing. So if someone's, even if a great runner is doing an easy run at 5.5 minute kilometer pace, it's still every time their foot hits the ground, it's still their full body weight going through the leg. And so I keep an eye on volume for sure, and certainly trying to get volume up to a point where it doesn't affect the cycling and swimming and is absorbable and showing benefits is a pretty big part of how I would coach an athlete. I think the other approach I take with it is to steer clear of chronic volume with my triathletes. So we might do, you know, a 5 to 10 day running block, but then we might back off for quite a bit and bring back the cycling. I find, you know, there's no doubt especially with pros, if you can get up to that 90-100 kilometer a week run volume, it's great. But I find if you start doing it week in, week out, the cycling, just you see the cycling really drop off. They start to sit too low in the water and in the swim. So I try to steer clear of, yeah, a chronic style of run volume, but it is an important part of the training, and having little blocks of high volume running, I think, really works. But of course, again, that's very individual. You know, I have some pros who just can't get over 80 kilometers a week without getting injured, and then some pros who are just bulletproof, and you can throw a lot of run mileage at them, and they continue to improve. So, I don't know how specific.
And 80 is quite a lot. You would see a lot of pros that are doing significantly less than that, at least if you look at it in terms of a, you know, quarterly average or something like that. It might be more 50k or 60k or even 40k in some cases.
100%. I mean, I say weekly mileage, looking at their bigger weeks, you know, I probably should, averaged it out, it would be a lot lower for many athletes, and some athletes, I mean, depending on what they're good at too, you know, if they're hugely aerobically efficient, then you might be working more at, you know, higher intensity, closer to higher lactate levels to sort of you can get that impact through the legs through faster running. And if they're you know, not super aerobically efficient, then, you know, sometimes you got to go the mileage route and really build up their sub threshold efficiency.
The next episode we'll hear from is, or the next guest, I should say, is Bex Milnes from episode 353. And she is the coach of athletes like Nikki Bartlett and India Lee. And for a long time, she was the lead paratriathlon coach at British Triathlon's Performance Center in Loughborough. I'll play the corresponding clips of her thoughts on swim, bike, and run training, just like I did with Tim Reed. So this will be interesting for you to keep your ears open, both for similarities and differences between her and Tim's approach.
I work across trying to develop, you know, an aerobic underpinning, an efficiency at first threshold, an efficiency at second threshold, and VO2, and that's kind of the bones of swim, bike, and run. I think for they each then have different nuances in how you tackle that, and again, it can be quite individually led. But swimming, I think. Some of the things that I consider is like just volume first and foremost, distribution of intensity. So the majority of the swim programs that I set would have a large aerobic component, probably 70-80% of the swim program that I would set is aerobic in structure. We may focus on like open water skills elements of that, or strength-based elements. But then the kind of main energy systems that I primarily focus on would be around that kind of second threshold or critical swim speed and VO2. And that's predominantly where we spend most of the intensity. That may flex a little bit through the year, like earlier on in winter, I tend to do a bit more of an anaerobic capacity stimulus or pure speed stimulus, because I find that kickstarts into the VO2 quite nicely. But fundamentally, it's the transferability to open water is the critical bit. And in order to swim open water well, it comes down to efficiency, but it comes down to kind of stroke rates, being able to manage the conditions that you're swimming in. A strong technical underpinning and a tactical awareness. So they're all elements which try to consider over the course of the year and prepare athletes for, really. But from a riding perspective, I similarly would intensity distribution would sit around 80-20, so a fair bit of aerobic riding. But what I tend to focus on with the aerobic riding stuff, a little bit dependent on time of year, but particularly as we're in race season, I would prioritize like how people are riding aerobically. And what I mean by that is aerodynamic drills, focus on holding race position, a little bit of like, particularly on the longer distance side, training for the demands of the course that you're doing. So if you're going to race a really hilly race, then I would certainly prescribe on aerobic stuff, like just getting used to overgearing, getting used to working over the top of hills or whatever it is. And then this is probably where it varies a little bit depending on distance. But from a riding perspective, if you're racing 70.3 or Ironman, then your first threshold you have to be super efficient around that. And I would structure at least a session a week that focuses on developing that. And I think generally if those sessions are done well and fueled well, the cost of them is relatively low for a session. But that has to be a focus. And then a little bit depending on the athlete engine and what I'm working with, whether they're, I kind of would term it as like more of a Ferrari or a diesel, would then determine kind of how I then structure either a second session in the week or a second emphasis on cycling, whether I'd sit more of kind of like a second threshold efficiency or a VO2. I tend to, as a general rule, prescribe a couple of bike sessions in a week, and then the rest is aerobic. And as we get closer to the season, we'd structure brick sessions off the back of either one of those aerobic rides or one of those key sessions. But I think, I'm big on riding in the position that you're racing in, preparing for the specifics of the course that you're riding, and making sure you're as efficient as possible. And that is time on bike. I think running for me is the thing which is most individualized, and it comes from a place of what loads athletes can tolerate. So I find that running is the discipline which leads to most injury and most time away from training. So again, if you're looking at the longer distance side of things, I would place a heavy emphasis on that first threshold and the efficiency around it. And obviously the shorter the distance you go, the more you're kind of trying to develop efficiency around second threshold, and VO2 plays more of a part. But fundamentally, it's similar in terms of intensity distribution through the week. But it depending on the individual and what they can tolerate, it may be more heavily weighted towards aerobic, and underpinned more by drills-based work. And then, again, intensity of a session, as I would see it, is for me determined more by what the athlete can tolerate. I think I've learned a lot around particularly working in para, where depending on impairment, there's a lot more asymmetries that you're considering, particularly around running, load bearing. You're dealing with run blades and how that impacts movement quality, load, et cetera, et cetera. So, I find running is a lot down to the individual and what they can tolerate. And so it becomes quite bespoke from there.
Next, we have Dr. Mark Burnley, who was a repeat guest on the podcast in 2022 after already having been on for the first time a couple of years ago. This time, we actually did a double episode with him. So we had episodes 330 and 331 with Dr. Mark Burnley. The following clip is from episode 331, where one of the topics we discussed was on polarized training and a crosstalk article that Mark and his colleagues wrote, where they were arguing that polarized training is not the optimal training intensity distribution for endurance athletes, and another group of researchers argued that it is. In this clip, we'll hear Mark explain the arguments that they used to explain why, in their view, it is not the most optimal training intensity distribution.
Well, the first and most obvious is that if you actually look at the time spent training, as opposed to, because there's a number of different ways in which you work out your training intensity distribution. So there's the time in zone and there's the total time spent training. When you look at, we were of the view that if you go out and do a training session, you don't just pick the bits where you're actually working. You also have to do the kind of the bits where you're not working. And so you actually have the whole package, because that is important. And when you do that, you end up, you in any training session, you're going to cross all three zones, essentially. So to say that you're trying to minimize one of those three zones and the one in the middle seems to us to be a bit strange. But also, when you look at the time people actually spend training, by and large, elite athletes will do something that looks pyramidal. So you'll do a lot of low intensity work. So most of your volume is low intensity. Then you have a smaller volume of zone two work, so in the middle, so the sweet spot work, and then a smaller amount still of zone three work. And one of the things that also kind of got me going with this as well was that the previous intervention studies that had been done on polarized training had often, I would say, unfairly compared it to what they might call threshold training. So they'd have a situation where they do essentially your 80% in zone one, so moderate intensity work, and then 20% in zone three, so your intervals and your high intensity work, and zero in zone two, as opposed to doing nothing but zone two and a little bit of zone one and then no zone three at all. And my argument would be, I have yet to come across an endurance athlete, or indeed any athlete, who doesn't do any training above the critical power. That's just not how people train at all. So that's not really a threshold training thing. Threshold training will also include zone three and some zone one as well. It's just that there's an emphasis on zone two, perhaps. There's also the fact that if you're not an elite athlete, you're not going to be achieving the same volumes that an elite athlete will, and therefore you're probably going to be doing less zone one work anyway. And as a result, your training is going to gravitate more and more towards threshold training by definition, because you're limited for time, so you want to use that time efficiently, so you'll tend to do higher intensity work. And that's where that comes from. The other argument that I had was, and this is perhaps a more difficult one to explain, but some of the reasons for using polarized training didn't make a lot of sense to me. So there's this argument that if you do a lot of zone two training, that will be autonomically stressful. In other words, you'll increase adrenaline, your markers of heart rate variability will change, indicating that you're overstressing yourself. And so that's why you might want to either avoid or minimize zone two work. And the evidence for that comes from a paper where, and it's one of Stephen Seiler's papers, it's a really nice paper, but it also actually illustrates that if you do zone two or zone three work, it has the same effect on these markers of stress. And so you can't really sustain the argument that you ought to avoid zone two if zone three does the same thing, because they're therefore equally stressful. Now, you might make the argument, well, if they're equally stressful, you get more bang for your buck in zone three, but you can't use the argument that you should avoid zone two because it's stressful if zone three does or has the same potential to overreach you, if you like. So there was that argument as well. The third one was that a lot of people advocate moderate intensity continuous training is the phrase that's often used in the literature and in coaching circles as well, which implies zone one. But actually, when you look at the literature, there are very few training studies that have looked at the physiological adaptations to zone one training. Most of the training studies which call themselves moderate and continuous are actually performed in zone two. So they're exercising at 60, 65, 70% of VO2 max in their continuous training. Well, that's for most people, and most of these people are undergraduate PE or sports science students. This is zone two. So you're using zone two adaptations to imply that zone one should be done and zone two should be ignored. So what I noticed from that was that the polarized training literature, or at least the literature on which polarized training relies mechanistically, is actually quite messy. And the other argument you sometimes get is that if you do high intensity exercise, you get less angiogenesis. So you get less capillarization if you do high intensity work. And again, a lot of that work has been done from single leg exercise, which is a completely different intensity spectrum to doing whole body exercise. And for that reason, I don't think there's a good, there's that much information out there that really tells you zone one is the thing to do. What I would also suggest, though, and this is speculation on my part, is that you also have to understand how big zone one is. In an elite athlete, zone one is a huge training zone because their lactate threshold is going to be higher than most other people, because they've got a lot of type 1 fibers, or they've trained them up and their type 2A fibers have been trained to behave more like type 1 fibers. And so their lactate threshold is going to be a very high proportion of their VO2 max, maybe 65-70% VO2 max. And so that means that when they do upper end of zone one training, the actual flux through the muscle in terms of oxygen, in terms of blood flow and that kind of thing is going to be rather high. And that's going to produce its own angiogenic stimulus, which is going to be higher than somebody who doesn't have that high lactate threshold. So using elite athlete responses to training to infer that this kind of training is right for everybody ignores the volumes they're doing, but also ignores their exercise intensity domain structure, which may be very different from a recreational athlete, for example. So it's this classic thing of one size does not fit all. That's where my kind of thinking was in terms of the potential limitations and if you like, overinterpretations of some of the polarized training literature.
Next, we have Dr. Tim Podlogar from Slovenia. He may well be one of a handful of people in the world that knows more about carbohydrates in endurance sport than anyone else. So we had an entire long episode dedicated to the science and practice of carbohydrates in endurance sports. I'll play two clips from this interview, with the first one about what to eat on race morning, where an important point that Tim makes is related to making sure that you consume fructose to restore liver glycogen. And the second clip is about carb loading, which Tim thinks is best done just one day before the event. But of course, it's important then that you do it right. So you can hear about that in the following clips.
If we are talking about like on the day, the main aim would probably be to replenish or fill up the both glycogen stores, so liver and the muscle. And I think this making a difference between the both stores is really important. Why? Because during the night, we will not be using any muscle glycogen stores. Whereas on the other hand, the brain is still working, the organs are still working, so we actually can reduce liver glycogen stores overnight. So the primary aim of the nutrition in the morning is basically to replenish liver glycogen stores. And this is kind of important when we're talking about carbohydrates, especially the sources of carbohydrates. We've recently done a study in which we gave people the same breakfast in terms of the quantity, but with different types of carbohydrates, so glucose or glucose and fructose. The reason being that fructose we know needs to first go into the liver, is metabolized there. And because it goes first into the liver, it takes care of liver glycogen stores first. And in that study, we actually found that time to exhaustion or time to task failure in the subsequent exercise was longer when people got glucose and fructose as compared to glucose only. So in practical terms, this would probably mean like some sort of rice or porridge oats, and it'll come back to these two ingredients in a bit. And then additionally, we want some sources of fructose, which is like honey, some jam, some juices, or anything like this. Most people recommend like multiple day glycogen loadings protocols, like 2 days in advance of a race. I always go with just one day glycogen loading. And the reason being that usually athletes also train the day before. So they go for like 1 hour activation ride or 1 hour or 2 hour spin. And based on the evidence, we know that the more glycogen you have stored, the more you will use it. So I see no sense or no point in like loading 2 days in advance when you will then just be using the lot of glycogen that morning before the race. So I think it's like enough if you just do like that training session the day before, very early in the morning, and then use this stimulus for like replenishing of the glycogen after it. So that you do like kind of a super compensation just after it, and then you just eat like 10 to 12 grams per kilogram of body mass on the day, little fats, moderate amount of protein, and I think this works very well. There is probably enough time to get the levels really high. And yeah, from experience from my athletes, this works pretty well so far. And like, even if you look at the professional cyclists, they don't have like 2 days between stages, and they usually successfully recover in 1 day and probably get the glycogen levels topped up. And then it's also like the next question is the duration. Do we really need always to do glycogen loading? And I would say pretty much yes, because we can like deplete glycogen stores in 1.5 to 2 hours. Like when we do in the labs glycogen depletion protocols, it's very funny to see that people last like 1.5 to 2.5 hours, and then they basically can't do anymore. And this means they are glycogen depleted, and that's the cause of fatigue. So you probably want to super compensate or like get glycogen levels topped up before any activities that are like, probably longer than 90 minutes, I would say.
The previous clip with Dr. Podlogar was from episode 354, by the way. I think I didn't mention it earlier, but that was episode 354. And the next one is Alan Murchison from episode 366. This is a very recent episode, so I may have some recency bias, but I think this was one of, if not the most enjoyable conversations I had all year. And this episode also had a lot of listener engagement. There were many clips that were worthy of being included here, but the one I ended up choosing was probably the most important and definitely the most serious one that we discussed, where Alan talks about the misplaced focus on weight and body composition as key metrics for endurance performance.
The other one, I think, and we touched on it earlier, metrics is measuring metrics. Now, I'm not a nerd. I'm not a particular nerd, but I think weight and body fat percentage is probably the metric that most people should be least concerned about. I've never seen anybody's body fat percentage on a result sheet any more than I've ever seen anybody's watts per kilo on a result sheet. It's irrelevant. And I would say, you know, again, you look at these amazing examples of athletes that are out there, and I think it borderlines, there's disordered eating across the board, and I think it's something that, you know, there's been two cases of lately, and again, my attitude, and you need to stop me, Michael, if I'm talking out of hand here, I generally don't use social media or any platform to talk badly about other people. I think if you've got nothing nice to say, then you shouldn't say it at all, but there's a couple of cases of late that struck out to me that I thought were reckless, talking about body fat percentage and weight, because I think what you've got to look at is anybody who's in the public eye that's a professional athlete. As a professional athlete, you've almost got a duty of care to the people that are looking at you. There's sponsors, there's young athletes that look up to you. There's people that don't actually understand the requirements of elite athletes. And I think when people start talking about the body fat percentage and their weight, that's such an unimportant measurement when it comes to performance. I just think it's almost the least relevant, because you and I know if you're going to have an athlete, and that matter whether it's Michael who wants to qualify for World 70.3 or somebody that wants to win the Olympics, the main thing that they're going to do is be able to absorb a high training volume, training load, and consistency. Consistency, consistency, consistency. If you are constantly depleted or you are operating at such a low body fat percentage that you're not robust, you're not able to absorb the training, you're not able to recover, you're not able to go out day after day, you're never going to achieve your goals. It doesn't matter whether you're Michael that works in an office or you're winning your third Olympics on the bounce. It ain't going to happen. And the two cases I want to talk about, and lately, there was a husband of a very famous athlete who said, oh, I'm at a race, I'm 4% body fat, you know, more than anybody that's racing here. What relevance is that of anything? You know, you're telling me that Christian Blumenfeld has stood on the start line and he's measuring his body fat? Nah. He's looked at how many hours he's logged. Yeah, it is completely and utterly irrelevant. And I just think that associating your body fat percentage with success, what does success look like, is dangerous. I think it's irrelevant, to be perfectly honest, for most athletes. And then there was another one that absolutely killed me, that there was again, I'm not going to name names. It was an athlete who's had a phenomenal season, won multiple big races. And they put out on social media, now bear in mind on Instagram, this athlete's got over 500,000 followers, right? That's a big reach, that they'd lost 3.5 kilos and they're now ready to race. Now, I'm guesstimating that's probably 6 to 8% of this athlete's body weight. That's what they'd lost. So they'd associated losing 3.5 kilos as being ready to race. That's reckless. That's absolutely reckless. And at that point, the sponsors of that athlete want to get on the phone and say, hey, this kid's looking at this. You know, there's athletes doing this. That is dangerous. Now, this athlete might have done it correctly. They might have been doing it for 10 years. They might have measured it. But that was the headline news for it. I just think that that's... But you also then look at the top end of the sport, the PTO, right? So the PTO have done some brilliant things. They put on races during lockdown. They've got, you know, athlete welfare at the forefront. You know, there's maternity pay. There's all sorts of stuff going on. You and I, Michael, we're sat on our sofa with our Big Mac, relaxing, and we are watching a PTO race. What flashes up? This athlete, and what's a metric that they've got on the athlete as it comes up on the screen? The athlete's weight.
Yeah.
Seriously, the athletes, they want to say, oi, 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 why is my weight on there? Because it's not a measurement of me as a person. It's not a weight, a measurement of my shape. And if you go onto PTO website, which I did the other day just to make sure I knew what I was talking about, there's only 3 female athletes in the top 10 that actually don't have their weight on the PTO website. Do you know who they are? The 3 best performing athletes. Well, not. You could say Ashley Gentle's got hers on there and she's been amazing. So, I'm not divulging. Kat Matthews, who, for me, if she hadn't had her accident, would have won Kona. Chelsea Sodaro and Taylor Nibb haven't got the weight on there. Why have the rest of them got on there? If somebody from the PTO asked me my weight, I'd say, why? It's not a judgment of where I am. So I think that is something that's really dangerous in elite sport. And I said, if you're looking into it, honestly, I would be more concerned about how many sessions in your 12, 14, 16-week training block did you fuel correctly? How many hours sleep did you get? How many hours did you spend training in a position? How many swim drills you do? Any metric you want, but going on, you've lost X amount of kilos, you're ready to race, or you're at 6% body fat. Seriously, do yourself a favor and don't worry about it. That's dangerous, and that's something that is a bad thing about elite sport. There's an obsession with weight.
Next on the list is Coach Glenn Pleonis from Belgium. He was on in episode 335, and he has a high-performance squad based in Girona, mostly focused on short course racing. I really enjoyed this interview because Glenn was really specific with his answers and explaining why he does things the way he does them. He was great at giving examples, and when saying things like "it depends," then he went on to explain what it depends on and how it depends, and those are all things that I really like when people do that, because training and coaching, that can be quite abstract. But Glenn was really great at describing things in a specific way and in a clear way. So the first clip that we will hear next is Glenn describing his approach to periodization, and then secondly we will hear what the volume and intensity looks like in the training of his athletes.
In general, it's like I always work like with a big base phase. It can be longer for one athlete, depending on how long the winter is, of course. If they start early, it's always minimum 8 weeks, I think, also for neuromuscular adaptations and on the cardiovascular level. If we want adaptations, it's really like a minimum, I think. And then sometimes if the season starts early, we go more into like a specificer phase, not really specific, more like a build phase where we do a bit more like already tempo work, big gear work, yeah, and then we switch to the specific phase where we like really, yeah, go to the trying to meet the race demands based on the individual profile, of course. And I always like try to have like within the season always like keep on repeating these phases as well, not make the specific phase too long, because the overall goal is always to like keep on improving over time. And if you like keep on going too long in too many races with too much specific work, yeah, you can just maybe hold on to your level and not keep on improving. And I think that's one of the basic philosophies, that sometimes in the season we have like a bigger period off again and repeat this base phase again, and to make sure we can keep on improving over time. Well, yeah, it depends a little bit on the anaerobic profile versus aerobic profile and the muscle fiber typology, I think, as well, I really look into. Also, boys versus girls, I am always a bit more careful with the girls, and do a bit, maybe especially for the run, I do a bit more strength work with the girls, I think, and a bit less volume, and make sure that I can keep on progressing in volume and intensity over time, not going too fast too soon. Yeah, and volume wise in general, I really believe in quite high volume, chronic volume, like, and then taper off at the right moment. But that volume is like really different for like the older athletes versus the younger athletes. And if you want some numbers, for example, like,
yes, please.
I was thinking, so like, I think in general with the elites, we're like quite regularly around 30 hours a week. So very consistent in the build phase and the base phase. So it's quite a lot of volume. It's divided maybe in 5 to 6 swims with 6 hour swim. Yeah, and bike numbers up to 15 hours, running around 100K for the very elite. So, and it's always a bit individual, like some focus a little bit more on the swim, some a bit more on the run. I'm not really into like bike or run weeks. I try to keep it quite consistent in over time in all three disciplines, because I always think it's like always injury prevention wise also very interesting to not to have many big fluctuations in the volumes. Yeah, and it helps to build like a big engine, I think, aerobically, and also like to have your loads really attenuated over time. I think it's very important. So
yeah. And what is, especially when you're in like a build phase or even a specific phase, how much intensity would you have in those weeks? Or do you have a typical like two hard swims, two hard bikes, two hard runs? Or is there anything, any patterns like that you use in terms of the intensity?
Yeah, I think intensity wise, it's like in the run, you can say it's quite typical. We always do like two harder runs, and the rest is like build up a volume around two specific sessions. So it's really not for athlete, never more than two hard runs. In the bike, I think now when we go like, for example, with Martin in the 70.3, we did a bit more emphasis on the bike. And maybe we did like 3 times like a bit more specific work on the bike, for example. And the swim, I really like to keep the intensity quite high. That doesn't mean like brutal workouts, not at all. Let's say if you want to put it in numbers, we have like 2 specific workouts, but like even regeneration sessions, we can do like little sprints to keep like the speed in. And so it can be like 4 workouts with a little bit of intensity in, but not like very brutal. So, it's not really fixed. Only our track Tuesday, maybe in the specific phase, like I think many athletes have like 2 fixed days for the run are quite fixed. But in general, it's really, not so determined in advance how many intensity we do in which discipline. No.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And what about recovery? Do you have any kind of down weeks, deload weeks, or do you work on a consistent schedule? Course.
Yeah. So, but it is what you call a down week, of course. Huh? Like, it's always like the athletes who do like 30 hours a week, on a regular base, then the down week might be 21, 22 hours, and it's like still a lot for other athletes. And if I have young athletes who are doing like consistent 23 to 24 hours, then a down week might be 16 to 18 hours. But I like to keep the consistency in the 3 sports as well, even in the down weeks, just shorter sessions, not too long, maybe 1 complete rest day, not too many rest days in general. It's really depending on what is your basic volume in the other weeks. Yeah.
And how often do you have these down weeks?
Sometimes with young athletes, it's more in like a 2-1 ratio, but often with the elite athlete, it's more like a 3-1, like type of coordination of the down week. So it's like depending a bit on the level as well.
Yeah. And within a week, the microcycle of a week, do you have
a day or a couple of days that are lighter generally, or maybe a day that is just swimming?
So in general, like on an easy day, we do even a few sessions. So it could be like on a Monday after a bigger weekend, because sometimes it's easier for the non-professionals to do more work in the weekends. We do like an easy swim. And then it depends, like they do like a little jog and gym work. That's then the easy day. And then like for the other people, it might even be like swim, gym, and like do a 2-hour easy bike ride on an easy day. It's always looking at what the athlete really wants to do as well, I think, on these days. Some really like to ride their bike and they really get recovered mentally as well of doing a 2-hour coffee ride with friends. And then I would also take that into account and look at the overall volume that we're not doing too much. And some people like to spread it a little bit more out. And sometimes I feel I have athletes, especially the more anaerobic athletes, sometimes they really need like a big afternoon off, or we just do an easy swim in the morning and that's it. And they get more recovered by doing completely nothing for maybe 20 hours, you know.
Next, we have Paulo Sousa, who was on in episode 360. He is a Portuguese coach and a pioneer in setting up a private triathlon squad outside of the control of national federations. His athletes have over the years gone on to have really great success. So the squad has in many ways been a model for other squads that have followed. Also, I should mention, because a lot of you guys probably follow Paula Findlay and Erik Lagerström, Paulo is their coach as well. And that has obviously been a very successful coaching relationship and continues to be so. In the clips that we'll hear from Paulo's interview, he first answers the question on what new athletes to his squad might experience as being different compared to what they have been used to before. And secondly, he describes some of the typical characteristics of his coaching methods. And I also want to add that I was lucky enough to spend a weekend in the south of Portugal with Paulo and his squad a few weeks after doing this interview. So that was a great experience for me. Big thanks to Paulo for allowing that.
Yeah, I think, like you said, experiences are very individual and dependent on the environment that they were in before. I think the biggest strength that our environment has is that we are able to maintain the drama to a low level, and being able to just really focus on the work and improvement and performance. I feel that like other squads, other environments, that a lot of the times there's too much of a high school environment that we work very hard to curtail or to diminish, so that we are able to focus on the day-to-day work. In terms of training, I feel that the biggest thing that I see is that there's a lot of programs, a lot of training programs out there in World Triathlon that are very intensity focused, and I get a lot of athletes that are used to doing a lot more intensity and are also like burnt out by intensity, meaning that they lack a real like endurance. They lack real endurance to approach the kind of races that we race at. And I feel that there's a lot of coaches out there that because triathlon is not a sport that's as established and as like the traditional sports, I feel that there's a lot of coaches out there that are still working to find their own system, their own formula, and they end up having programs that have way too much intensity, and the athletes, when they come to the squad, end up having, there's this clash in philosophies where they're used to just doing a lot more intensity, less volume, and also the impact that those high intensity programs had on their bodies throughout the years makes a big difference in their performance now and adapting to our training now. in terms of like training philosophy, I wouldn't say like, well, I'm a volume guy that does a little bit of intensity. My approach is like polarized. I wouldn't say something like that. It's more that we have a way of doing things that it's more a question of like execution and how we operate on the day to day, and less about the training content and what we do, and also adjust things based on athlete feedback. In general terms, I would say that like some philosophies in endurance training that I am more, that I'm closer to, would be for example, polarized training or whatever you want to call it, even though like lately it seems that everything is polarized training. But I would say that like I am closer to a polarized approach than other approaches. But for example, like in the last two seasons, we've been doing a lot of fat max training on the bike or Ingebrigtsen training on the run, and those concepts are definitely not polarized training. And so I feel that like in terms of training philosophy, I would say that like flexibility on the approach, and also have training that I feel that either by the specific content that it's got or by the personal preference that athletes have for it, I will then like choose that. So instead of like being in a box where like, this is what we do, this is our approach, I think that more individuals and specificity are going to be the key factors in the overall training philosophy.
Next up is Owen Everard from episode 336. Owen is a physiotherapist from Ireland, and this episode was a really great one on injury prevention, also with strength training, a lot of strength training discussions, which is part of injury prevention, of course, but also performance benefits and whatnot. And we also discussed running biomechanics in some detail. In the following clip, Owen discusses some key principles for avoiding injuries. So this is a really great tidbit that hopefully will be really useful for you, so you can have a great injury-free 2023.
Yeah, I think as we said, like the key things, the first one would be variation. I think that's why like coaches like the Scientific Triathlon are so important, not just physiologically to make sure that you get the most out of the training you're doing, but also from an injury perspective. I find that people that don't have a coach tend to just revert to the same type of training, or a major mistake I find that that say novice triathletes can do is just constantly doing the same training. Like they might just go out for the same run or do the same cycle, or, and what happens there is there's no variety. So the same type of tissue is getting overloaded, and the same joint range is getting moved into. So it's really important that you're bearing up your training, like having some threshold work in there, some intervals, say some long running, and we'll come back to that as well. You know, changing your surface, changing your shoes you have sometimes. One thing I really recommend for people is like running strides. I like uphill strides. I'm on a slight incline. And I recommend those for several reasons. One or two I'll talk about later, but the main reason is that it increases the amount of range of motion that you're doing. And that, like a joint, if you can imagine it having like, it's synovial fluid, but if you can think of like oil fluid, oil on your chain of your bike, it's like by moving the joint through the range of motion, by lengthening out those muscles, that allows the joint to move healthily, which really helps. The second thing, as we said, was it's the passive structures getting overloaded because the muscular system has got lazy, essentially. So you need to wake that up. And how you do that is to strengthen the muscles. That can either be done through like sports Pilates, where you get the muscles really burning, or to gym work. And I know listening to your previous podcasts, you'd be an advocate of that as well. And again, of lifting heavy. Like, don't be afraid of DOMS initially or progressing what you're doing. Like, when we're doing the Pilates, you're getting the muscles to burn, and it can be a bit of a shock for triathletes initially because they're not used to, you know, they're not used to really working or going to a gym and starting to lift. But I'm like, you're sitting 8 to 10 hours a day. It's going to take more than a 30 second stretch to rebalance your body. It takes, like, you know, I do Pilates maybe once per week is your minimum, but it takes like a good 45 minutes once a week, or maybe 20 minute splats, two or three times a week, and really burn the muscles. You got to wake these things up. They are lazy. They are lazy, lazy, lazy. So you need to wake these up. And it's like, oh, why did it get lazy? It's like, you sit 10 hours a day. It's not a stretch that's going to get you out of that. It's not, I stretch my glutes, you know, bring the leg over, and I wonder why it's not kicking in. It's really activating those muscles, you know, to get them burning, as I said. And then that allows them, because then once they're primed, essentially, because you've innervated them, you've excited them, when you're running then, or even when we're like swimming or whatever, you're getting those stabilizer muscles they're much more activated. So they're much more ready to be able to take the load. It's like having a guy asleep and you're doing all the work. Say that's our passive system. It's like, if you wake him up and he's like on caffeine, he's just there naturally going to be like, oh, here, I'll lend a hand. So that would be the second thing, really strengthening the muscles. And that takes, if you could do that, as you said, all the injuries that triathletes get will be passive injuries. It's very rare. If it is even a muscle strain, it's not because you strain the muscle. It's most likely, like, say, an SI joint or something is caught, and the muscle is kind of just being overloaded again, as opposed to a tear. Just thinking about some of the exercises, if you want, we can go before, let's go for the next, next point there. The first one I think is really good is the single leg deadlift. So what that is, you stand on one leg, I slightly bend the knee on the leg I'm standing on, and you bring the other leg back as far as you can. So like a pendulum. Now you want to keep the leg that's lifting and your body in a line. And as the key faults I see with that, as soon as the back leg stops lifting, stop lowering your body. So initially you might be only like 10 or 20 degrees off vertical. That's fine. It's better that than people like fold in their back and they're not going to get it in the position. Why I really like the single leg deadlift, it really works all the posterior chain, which have a tendency to weaken. And it works on balance, and it works in that like standing position. So single leg deadlifts, again, I would do sets of five seconds, holding for like reps of 10 and maybe three sets. And again, you should be burning. Like, I can't overemphasize, how do you know when to stop? When your leg is on fire and you shake out the leg. Like, anyone who has any calf injuries, shin or Achilles, I can't recommend that exercise enough. A lot of times people do heel drops, heel raises, which are fine in certain cases, but a lot of times the calf, again, because the range of motion and the knee lift isn't there for people when they run, the calf is overloaded. So a lot of times what we try to do is strengthen an overloaded area rather than get the other areas working to take load off that area. You know, it's the same at the knee. A lot of times we're doing excessive amounts of squats or lunges, which are fine for appropriate load, but make sure that the other parts of the chain are strong.
Next, we have a clip from my interview with Erin Carson in episode 367. Another very recent one, but I really loved this episode, and Erin's wealth of knowledge was something that I tried to really soak up. She's really good at explaining how and why she does things the way she does them. So even though you probably listened to this one quite recently, I think it's worth including here, because for me, it was definitely one of the highlights of the year. In the clip that you'll hear, Erin takes us through what a typical session in the gym looks like for her athletes. And I don't think in the clip she says it, because I think it is earlier in the episode, but For context, when her athletes go to the gym, they are there for no longer than 45 minutes. Erin, think that that's, well, it's not good use of time. So keep in mind that for the context of the following workout, it would take 45 minutes or less to do all of the things that she goes through.
Typical 45-minute session will always start with some movement, mobility that is geared towards undoing some of the tightness that naturally comes from swim, bike, run. So tight pecs, tight hips, tight ankles. So we'll move and we'll look for a high quality of movement. We want that really softness in their movement. We want flow. If we don't see that, if I don't see that, we'll take more time for that mobility. We'll take more time for tissue care. Some athletes enjoy foam rolling, some don't. Some athletes like the massage gun, some don't. So I'm not partial to anything. We just kind of give each athlete the opportunity to experience each modality that we would use for tissue care and then hope that they really resonate with one. So whenever I come in, I don't direct the first 5 or 6 minutes of the session. I just kind of see what the athlete chooses because it's interesting. Some of them are so set in their ways that they'll choose the same thing every time, even if they don't have the intuition yet to say, I don't need to do that. Like I'm looking to see, does the athlete come in and always go, oh, I'm going to foam roll my lower leg. Now I'm going to foam roll my hips. Now I'm going to foam roll my upper back. That athlete is very regimented and I might guide that athlete a little bit more and try and throw some curveballs at them and say, don't do that today. Do this first. And it freaks them out to do something else first. I've had a couple of those in the past. Don't have any of those right now. And usually an athlete will show me exactly where they need more motion because if they come in and stick that foam roller in their armpit and lay sideways on it, I would say that their thoracic spine is feeling tight. They're seeking more motion there. And they didn't say, I think I'm not moving well. They just intuitively went there. If they sit on the foam roller and put their right foot on their left knee and just start moving through their hips, I know that they've been working their butt off and their hips need to maybe be open a little bit more. So I will really watch that first 5 or 10 minutes to see where I think the session needs to go in addition to what I've already got planned. But the most important thing is mobility first. Then we'll do some light loading to enhance mobility and bring up that motor unit recruitment and just make sure everybody's in the game. And as I describe movement and loading.
What does light loading mean here in this?
I might use a 10-pound weight that has no representation of percentage of one rep max. It has no reason other than it's 10 pounds. And when you reach that across to your knee, it's going to give you a little bit more inertia to open up some more tissue. I typically don't look at muscle. I look at movement. I train the fascial system and the connective tissue. And I see the muscles within these little bundles of fascia. So instead of training the quads, I'm training the whole lower body. And instead of training the hamstrings, I'm training the whole back line of the body. So a lot of that learning from me came from a book called Anatomy Trains, written by a gentleman named Thomas Myers. And in Boulder, we have the Structural Integration Institute in Rolfing. And when people get stuck in movement, the fascial system typically and the nervous system shuts that movement down. And those people are so beautifully trained to enhance movement by working with the fascial system. And we've been very fortunate to have time to learn from Thomas Myers and understand movement and how we can strengthen movement and build trust with the nervous system so that the body can actually move better. So there's lots of layers to how I approach performance and strength and conditioning.
But that part with the light loading, it's dynamic movements designed to just facilitate better
enhanced movement.
Okay.
Yep. Absolutely.
And then what's the next part?
And then we're going to get under load with the muscles that might have become inhibited because of tightness. So if there's tightness, like that's why everybody loves to talk about glute function. So I definitely want upper back function, scapular stabilization, glute function, ankle mobility. If the foot and ankle are not moving well, the glutes will not fire well. So we need to make sure the foot and ankle are moving well. We use a lot of balance boards. I think some of your listeners might have heard of a MOBO board, M-O-B-O board. One of our friends, Jay Deshari, invented that. Jay wrote a book called Anatomy for Runners. We have a nice community that supports each other. And the MOBO board is a big part of the work that we do, which enhances the loading of the big toe and how that plays to make sure an athlete is loading their big toe. It's really important. And that just clicks on up the chain to make sure that your body is stable and strong.
Yeah. And is that the end of the session or is there another part after that?
Well, then we're going to get into strength and that's the irony of it all, right? So you're a strength coach, but that's the last thing you get to. And so,
that previous part, you still want to do it under load. So you still use some weights, at least depending on what the issues are. Okay.
100%. Yep. So the heavier loading strategies definitely enhance the hormonal profile of the athletes. And as the athletes get a little bit older and get into their 30s and maybe even into their 40s, that heavier loading strategy becomes part of the hormonal profile. And I think, as we know, endurance athletes sometimes might struggle with a hormonal profile that skews a little bit to lower testosterone. And that it challenges the athlete's ability to recover. It might challenge their mood. It might challenge a lot of other things. So we look at using heavy load and building technique and skill under heavier loads to ensure that our athletes can use some physical challenges to help all the systems of the body, mental, emotional health as well.
What would that part of the session look like? Do you have 2, 3, 4 exercises and you do how many sets of each and reps?
So each athlete will resonate towards 2 or 3 heavy lifts that we want those athletes to get very good at. The hex bar deadlift is very accessible to a lot of people. It's very low risk. I'm very risk averse. So anytime you put an athlete under load, you're putting them at risk. So you better make sure that they're in really good physical preparation for those lifts. So most of my athletes are very good at the hex bar deadlift, and we can use that as one of their heavy lift. Some of them are more comfortable with a goblet front squat. So they're going to put the dumbbell or the kettlebell on the front side of their body. I only back squat one athlete, and that's because she grew up back squatting and she does it very, very well. And I have back squatted actually Jeannie Seymour as well, but Rinny is a great back squatter. She's the only athlete that I back squat. But the spinal, I'm not going to say kyphosis, but spinal flexion that we experience on the bicycle. So that little bit of rounded spine and the tightness on the front side of the body sometimes will make it very difficult for an endurance athlete to get under a back squat. And I find that puts that risk profile is just too high for me. So I am a front squatter through and through. We can do an Olympic bar on the front side of the body, but there are some athletes that are very uncomfortable in that position. So we're going to deadlift. We're going to front squat. We're going to do a lot of high pull down exercises, either a lat pull down or something similar. A single arm shoulder press is something that we get under, but we very rarely will bilaterally press overhead. Just because why risk a shoulder? That doesn't really help them as much. So single arm presses allow you to rotate and elevate one shoulder or the rib cage if you want. And bent over rows, heavy bent over rows, single leg, double leg, supported, unsupported. We do a lot of rowing. So each athlete has their 3 or 4 lifts that when we want to get them under load, it's low neural demand because they've become so good at it. So the neural challenge is low. I just say, we're going to row today, double arm, single arm, whatever it is. They're not freaked out by it. They don't have to use much energy to get in there and do it.
Next up is an interview with UK-based cycling coach Tom Bell from episode 356. This interview, I think, was a great example of somebody who is really good
at understanding training science, physiology, but at the same time is very much grounded in practice and doesn't let themselves get shackled by the science. And of course, this can be said for many others on this list as well. But I think in the interview with Tom, it really stood out to me, maybe more so than in most interviews that I've done this past year. So we'll hear two short clips, one on training progression, which is a question I think I should ask more coaches, because it's a really interesting one, and I really don't have a huge database of answers to this one like I do with some other questions. And the second topic that we will hear about is recovery, which Tom discusses being one of the main things that changes for a lot of athletes when they start working with Tom.
Yeah, I think early on, sometimes you get into the trap of trying to make the training a little bit too varied and, change sort of every week, which has its advantages. You know, it keeps things fresh for the athlete. It gives them sort of new challenges. But I think repeating, if you kind of take the idea that there are only going to be a certain amount of workouts that, that are optimal for that athlete and what they're working on at that point in time, I do think it's very useful to actually repeat the same kind of workout design, you know, for a period of time. So you have that more direct comparison that you can apply. In terms of how we then go about progressing those workouts, I think sometimes you can fall into the trap of arbitrarily adding a certain amount of, repeats to a single interval, to a set of intervals, or if you're maybe performing some sort of over under style interval blocks, you know, you might add a couple more micro components to those, but that is fairly arbitrary. You know, who's to say whether adding two repeats is the right thing to do? So often the way we approach it is, you know, we'll have them perform the sort of first new session. And then going forward from there, we'll sort of say, okay, and repeat the same interval protocol. And then in the final interval, just go a little bit longer and just go to that point where it feels like, you know, you're pushing to a level where you're working hard, but there's a little bit left, and then you can essentially let the athlete find, you know, the right level of progression, and not sort of impose that fairly arbitrarily from the coach side. Yeah, I think quite often the most common thing is that quite a lot of motivated athletes don't have an issue with training enough. It's, you know, getting them to rest and recover and actually sort of adapt to the training. So I think a lot of people kind of direct their attention to their training capacity, so maybe how many hours they have for training, but don't really sort of turn the lens around and look at their recovery capacity. So, you know, maybe they could squeeze out 12 hours of total training time, but, you know, are they able to recover from that and do that repeatedly, you know, week after week, month after month on a consistent basis? Maybe in that example, you know, training 10 hours a week and then having a little bit more recovery time might be the way that athlete, you know, improves more. So, you know, trying to sometimes get across that slightly contradictory idea that resting a little bit more might actually be the way to get faster or to get more powerful, is perhaps one of the things that we tend to find we're implementing more often than not.
And last but certainly not least, we have a clip with Andrew Sellers from episode 361. This was an episode that got a lot of great feedback, particularly among the technically minded and the physiology nerds, and for good reason. It was definitely one of my absolute favorite episodes of the year. I'll play two clips from this interview, one on how to use testing to assess limitations and plan training interventions with specific case studies, and the other one on how the respiratory system can be a limiter that we don't really think of much and talk about much. After doing this interview, I actually told myself that I have to start learning more about this topic, respiratory training and the respiratory system as a potential limiter. Sadly, I have been extremely busy and I just haven't gotten around to it yet, but I am still in contact with Andrew and we might actually be able to get together and do some work on this, discuss this in this year. So there might be some follow-up episodes as well from then. Fingers crossed we can make it happen. Either way, hope you enjoy this one. Again, really interesting physiology-related episode with Andrew.
A good example, cross-country skier. So they come to us for testing because they're having some performance limitation. Their coach has found that they look like they ski really well. They have good technique. They're in a short sprint. They're able to ski as fast as anybody else on the hill. But they get into a race and they're struggling to keep up in a 10K race. This is a junior athlete. And so at the time, we were limited to testing somewhere. And this comes down to what are you actually testing? So from a physiologic perspective, and this is in our ideal world, we would test them on skis. But this athlete's training off season. So we don't have access to snow. We don't have access to a really expensive skate mill, so we can't put them on an indoor workout that simulates the work that they're doing. So we're now looking, trying to find the physiologic limitation that athlete might have that would prevent them from performing on an endurance event on the snow the next winter. So we tested that athlete both running and cycling. They were doing cycling as an off-season sport. But we looked at both their running and their cycling performance to see if we could identify physiologic limitations. And what became clear for that athlete is they had two limitations. One, they had a heart rate that went exceedingly high very early in the test. So even at very low intensities, their heart rate was already stimulated to overbeat what we expected. So it identified that they had a very small heart that had to beat very quickly in order to provide the cardiac output that they needed for performance. So they had structurally a small heart. The second problem that they had is one of the things that was driving that was an exceedingly high respiratory frequency. So they also weren't making proper use of their diaphragm and using their lungs. So with two very simple interventions that were focused on cardiac development and respiratory diaphragm usage, they shifted their training through the rest of the summer and had a much better performance the following winter with ability to sustain long intervals on skis with lower heart rates and slower breathing patterns. And I don't think that coach ever would have figured that out. They would have just kept pushing them harder and harder and harder to try and overcome what was a perceived inability to tolerate high intensities for long periods of time for a 10K race. And unfortunately, I think that would have burnt that athlete out and somebody would have told that athlete that they just didn't have what it would take to be performing at a high level. So the initial studies were done on people with known breathing problems. But then the theory came out that, well, if people with asthma have a problem, what happens in people who don't have asthma? Do they have a limitation? So the first very simple test, it was not Spengler, the first one, I'm trying to remember who did the very first respiratory test. It was a fascinating test. So what they did was they took an isocapnic breathing bag, basically a glorified paper bag, and they had cyclists breathe as hard and fast as they could for 5 minutes. And then they put them on a ergometer and had them cycle a 20-minute time trial. And nobody could hit the same numbers after breathing hard for 5 minutes. And they all just said, I can't ride my bike. I'm too tired from breathing. Mm. And that became the fundamental basis for all the studies that came after that is why are they struggling on a time trial if all we did was challenge their breathing? It's because breathing can be a limiting factor to performance. And that's if you remember that most of the work of high intensity breathing is that should be done by the diaphragm. But it's just a skeletal muscle. It's a slow twitch. It's 100% slow twitch muscle fibers. the additional muscles when you breathe really hard, intercostal muscles, abdominal muscles, interscalenes, and sternocleidomastoid, all fatigue just like any other muscle does. And if you need to support fast breathing because of the high intensity of the activity you're doing, and those muscles are already fatigued, you can't keep up with the elimination of CO2, and then your physiology falls apart because you're producing more acid and you can't eliminate the CO2, and your pH goes out of whack, and then you your body shuts down because you can't maintain the physiologic homeostasis without the breathing muscles. So it's very simple to see that if you fatigue the muscles, they don't work as well. Yeah. And then the next part is, if you train the muscles, can you actually get better? And the answer is, of course you can. They're skeletal muscles. So if you train them to be better, then you won't have that as a limitation anymore.
And there we go. I hope that you enjoyed that list of highlights from 2022. And yeah, I hope that you enjoyed listening to that Triathlon Show throughout the year. Of course, there are many other episodes that could have made this list. I actually had quite a few others picked out that I felt like this was a really good episode and I really want to include something from it. But then I started putting the episode together and I realized that it was already getting quite long. So I just had to limit it to a few fewer episodes than I had maybe initially hoped to do, because at the same time I didn't want to include super short clips, or some of the clips that I included, it didn't make any sense to shorten them because then you would leave half of the part out, so they just had to be a bit longer. But you can find the show notes as usual on scientifictriathlon.com, and you can find links to all of these episodes in full if you want to check them out. And before we finish for today, I also want to remind you to check out our training camp in Mallorca coming up at the end of March. You can find all the information on our website, scientifictriathlon.com, and you can, of course, email me directly if you want to talk more about it, learn more about what we'll do. It will be an amazing week of training in a cycling paradise, so you don't want to miss this opportunity to come and train with us, talk with us coaches from Scientific Triathlon, train with a bunch of like-minded people, and build some great fitness and readiness for your 2023 season. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on Precision Fuel and Hydration.com. Use their free fuel and hydration planner to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs and get a specific and effective race strategy, and book a free video consultation with the team if you want to refine it further. Use the code TTS23 at checkout for 15% off your first order. And thank you to Form, that you can find on formswim.com/TTS. Improve your swim training with real-time metrics like pace, stroke rate, and heart rate, and advanced post-swim analysis. Use the code TTS15 to get 15% off the Form Smart Swim Goggles. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.